Okay, so many of you may recognize that piece, and if you don't, shame on you. That's a pretty classic intro to a very famous song. Folks may or may not know that while that was done, recorded essentially for Ringo Starr, formerly of the Beatles, obviously. And if you don't know who the Beatles are, you really need to get bitch smacked. But at any rate, that was written predominantly by George Harrison, who also plays guitar in that section, which he does through a Leslie, which is why you have that whirling sound. So that kind of off-sync, kind of spirally, sort of phase shiftery kind of sound that you hear is not an artifact of this recording profile that I'm using, or platform that I'm using right now, but actually from a real Leslie, excuse me, which is something that I acquired recently to put in my studio. Most of you know I'm putting one in my home so I can do a lot of recording and stuff and maybe get a better quality one of these out, right? So that was intentional warbling through a real Leslie. The Leslie Corporation is recently, or the Hammond Corporation, I should say, or Suzuki, depending on your framework. I'll get to that in a minute. Recently made a Leslie specific for guitar players because through the years, guitar players have been notoriously absconding with Leslies for their own purposes, most notably on the piece I just played for you. But Harrison used it a lot in several Beatle recordings off of the later stuff, off of Abbey Road and the White Album, Sgt. Pepper's, Magical Mystery Tour, excuse me, just a variety of stuff. The other really famous part that most of you know, although you probably don't know you know it, is midway through the song Badge by Cream. There's a piece in there that's very significant that has a Leslie guitar. And if you listen to that, you go, well, gosh, that kind of sounds like a Harrison guitar. Well, yeah, you know, there's a real good reason for that, because that's not Eric Clapton playing, that's Harrison playing the guitar part. Since he is the co-author of that song with Eric Clapton. But given their record label commitments, he couldn't be identified. So if you look at the record recording of it, whether it's in CD form or vinyl form or whatever, you'll see that the rhythm guitar part is credited to a gentleman known as Lengelo Mysterioso, which was George Harrison's nom de musique when he would play with other artists that he wasn't supposed to play with because of his affiliation with various labels, which is why Eric Clapton, by the way, never got credit for playing the lead solo on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which is definitely him playing it. So for those of you who didn't know that one. So the reason I wanted to play that for you was partly to show off my Leslie, because I'm like really happy that I have it. It's a pretty unique piece. You don't see too many folks having that unless they're really big into the Hammond organ scene. For those of you who may or may not know the history of the Leslie, or even know what that is, that's those big boxes that you often see next to the big church organs or the big two keyboard organs with the big square box next to it, the whirling speakers in it. That's called a Leslie, right? And that has sort of been the hallmark of Hammond organs, particularly the BC and the C3 models that they've used through the years. And the initial Hammonds did not have Leslies on them, by the way. That came later in the evolution of the excuse me, of the Hammond, because the original Hammond organs that were, you know, made obviously by you know, the person who invented them, which is Lawrence Hammond, together with a guy named John Hannert, I think that's how you pronounce his name. It goes back all the way to something like the mid 30s, 1935, 36, whatever. And they were, Hammond Organ Company was around for a really long time until they were bought out by various folks. And currently, the corporation is known as the Hammond-Suzuki Corporation that produces them. Hammond at one point was bought out by the Suzuki Musical Corporation, Instrument Corporation, which is why they have the hyphenated name. So that's why they're known today at that. I think they bought them in the mid-80s, I think, 85, 87, something like that. At any rate, the Leslie that has that grinding noise, that grinding kind of whirling speaker thing, because that's what it is, was not originally on the original Hammond's organs. A gentleman, obviously, by the name of Leslie, gee, would imagine that, was the first person to decide to build this, or this little add-on, so to speak. And when Donald Leslie, the originator of the Leslie, which is kind of an integrated speaker amplifier in a box, which has a rotating horn speaker on the top and has a compression driver and rotating woofer bass speaker on the bottom, where the baffle rotates, so you get this real warbly kind of cool effect. And if you have it gives you like this Doppler shift effect. So any of you who have heard phase shifters, or some of the Univibes like Hendrix used to use, those are all basically electronic variations and emulations of the Leslie, choruses, all that sort of stuff. That thing has become so popular that recently, I think in 2013, the Leslie company actually started manufacturing, the Leslie / Hammond company, Suzuki started manufacturing a stomp box that is an electronic emulation of the Leslie. So if you really want that Leslie sound to get as close as you can without logging this huge-ass, extremely heavy piece of equipment around, you can get this pedal and sound pretty close to a Leslie, but honestly, nothing beats the real deal Leslie, which is why I got one. It's just something about that moving an air thing that just really sounds awesome. So a lot of the rock guys took this thing over and have done all kinds of cool things with it, even though the original, Hammond organ people were everybody from, Albert Schweitzer to George Gershwin. I mean, for real. Count Basie used one. Fats Waller used one. I mean, these things were really, really, really well-known in the jazz community and the classical community. Jimmy Smith, who was a Hammond player back in the 50s, Blue Note label recordings, used them. And eventually came to light in the rock and roll arena. Probably made popular by folks such as, even prior to that, Booker T and the MGs, the organist, James Taylor, different organist, said that it became popular in the UK. He was a British organ player, because of people like Booker T and the MGs using it. Matthew Fisher, who was the guy that played the Hammond B3 organ on A Whiter Shade of Pale, the Procol Harum song. Obviously, it's like a key organ song. So any of you folks, who go back and listen to some of those songs, and you'll go, oh my God, is that what that is, right? Or Steve Winwood, when he was with the Spencer Davis Group, playing the Give Me Some Lovin' organ part on the Hammond B3, that's the Leslie, that grindy sound. It's got an unmistakable tone to it that people just love, including myself, and obviously a lot of guitar players as well. Greg Allman used it one, John Lord, Deep Purple's keyboard player, and of course people like Keith Emerson, who has been a B3 guy for a long time. So I mean, a lot of your guys, rock guys, have used it. Rod Argent of the Zombies and Argent, obviously. Tony Kaye of Yes, Rick Wakeman of Yes, the keyboard player for Focus used it. Van Leer. Ken Hensley, the keyboard player for Uriah Heep, used it. Rick Wright, the Pink Floyd keyboard player, used it. Steve Walsh for Kansas. Tony Banks for Genesis. I mean, these things just really are just iconic instruments. You cannot get away from these if you listen to any classic rock, or even stuff with Bob Marley and the Wailers, for example. Tyrone Downey had one. I mean, this thing reaches a large audience. Everything from jazz to classical, to hard rock and heavy metal, to reggae and ska, to pop rock to just about, you know, R&B to just about everything. So it has definitely made the rounds and still, in my personal opinion, the keyboard of choice if you're going to play a certain kind of genre of music. And obviously, if you're playing church music or praise music or any of that kind of stuff, that's those big, you know, things you see in church organs. They've made some popular, more portable versions of these for the rock guys because most people don't want to, you know, haul a whatever those things weigh, 500-pound organ. Those Leslie cabinets are not light either, although the Leslie, they make different size Leslies, and obviously I got a smaller one for the guitar because I'm not going to be hauling that thing out. And even so, using this guitar model, it is really, really heavy for something that small. The thing weighs like 105, 110 pounds, and I told one of my buddies, this is the true measure of delusional behavior when a 140-pound guy thinks he's going to lift 105, 110-pound Leslie out of a car and take it into his house by himself. And that would, of course, be me. So, you know, just because I have degrees and been doing this for a long time, both musically and psychologically, doesn't mean I can't be a moron or delusionally evaluative of my own physical prowess, which obviously is not very good. So I managed to get it out of the car and on the floor of the garage before my back went, now we're going to bitch smack you because you've been a dumbass. So I had to come to my senses very quickly and get the neighbor's kid to come help me, you know, help the old fart get it into his house. So it was pretty comical in retrospect, but it was not funny for the week my back was going ding, 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 ding from me being a dumbass. So, you know, there you go. You can't muck with Mother Nature. I keep telling everybody that. But anyway, I was all excited to get the Leslie and play it. And so I thought I'd open this session up with that and let you folks hear what a real one sounds like, albeit disguised on this you know, less than preferable platform to record on. And also the song that opening up for sort of going to reflect what I'm going to talk about this evening, as it always does. But as you know, those of you who've heard me before, and thank you for continuing with me. And I'm sorry, by the way, sorry this one has been about a month coming. I had intended to get this thing out a lot sooner. But, you know, what's the John Lennon quote? You know, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. Don't ever have I know this is going to sound crazy, and I don't mean this to sound sacrilegious or, you know, offensive or anything, but, you know, it really sucks when family members die and you're the one left to manage stuff, because, oh, my flipping Jesus, has society made getting one's estate or the former person who was alive's estate in order and manage things that are still around after the person is no longer there and you're the person who has to do it, oh my gosh, is that a complicated and annoying process, especially for those of you who have no financial investment, stocks and bonds, CDs head amongst you, which would definitely be moi. This has been almost torturous. Now, you know, the good news is, obviously, you know, I'm getting to an education in financial planning and investment and stuff. The bad, you know, and I'm helping folks who are left manage this thing for them, but oh my gosh, it's just been a total nightmare. So I've had meetings with all kinds of folks, which have taken up all kinds of my time, which is my sort of lame roundabout way of saying this is why you haven't seen one of these from me sooner than I'd planned. So that and my back killing me after me making the stupid delusional behavior thinking I was going to be able to get this thing into the car by myself. Yeah, out of the car by myself and, you know, somehow make this all wonderful and play, you know, thinking I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger's double or something. At any rate, yeah, like that's going to happen. At any rate, part of what I wanted to discuss tonight, because I've seen a lot of this in the news lately, and of course I run into this in my practice and in my work at the alternative school that I do 2 days a week, running groups there. You know, I get a lot of people will say, you know, well, you know, my parents had this, or this runs in my family, or this runs in my family, you know, or I've got depression, or I've got, you know, ADHD, or whatever, and, you know, or I've got this addiction problem, and, you know, both the sides of my family have it, or, you know, my father had it, or whatever, and so I've got it, and I'm kind of this doomed guy, and whatever, you know. And you folks have heard me talk about this on a previous podcast before, but I think it bears repeating because so many people want to use their family's genes as an excuse for their misbehavior. And I'm here to tell you that stuff doesn't fly. Okay, it just doesn't flippin' fly because addictions run on both sides of my family, and I've never even been drunk, much less tried pot. I'm allergic to cigarettes. Well, I'm allergic to the chemicals they put in the cigarettes. So I just, you know, what same difference, right? So don't give me this, oh, you know, poor me, I've got this problem. Well, yeah, you got a problem, but you got a problem because you created the problem, okay? And, you know, oh, I've got depression, I've just got to take these pills. Well, no, I think that's really a bad idea. Now, again, don't mishear me, folks. You know, if you have clinical depression, you got to do something about it, right? And if you have to take medication in the short run, you know, or if you come to the table because your, you know, brain's a little funky wired because you inherited a, you know, a misanthropic serotonin system that your brain doesn't produce in their serotonin, so you're much more prone to depression, then, you know, don't be stupid about it. But even then, I mean, I think, I don't know if most of you are aware that there's been a lot of research in the last year or two about long-term use of serotonin drugs have caused really nasty things to happen to your brain. And now we're finding all this out 20 years later after people have been on things like, you know, Prozac and, you know, gosh, I'm having a brain fart, sorry, folks. But Zoloft and that sort of thing, all the SSRIs, they're thinking, well, now we shouldn't be on these things more than 2 or 3 years. Yeah, well, thanks a lot, buddy, right? So what do you do if you have one of those things, right? Well, if you have clinical depression and it's one of, and you're one of the few unlucky persons who have inherited a genetic brain defect where your brain just doesn't produce enough serotonin, right, then obviously you have to do something about that. Because it's not cool to be depressed. So, but you know, as I've said in previous podcasts, there are tons of stuff you can do. You can go for therapy and learn to rework your brain's self-talk, you know, through cognitive behavioral therapy, which has been found to be one of the best forms of therapy for depression and anxiety, I might add. A lot of things, actually, but depression, anxiety in particular, right? You can learn to rethink stuff. You can learn to tell your brain different messages, to release different biochemistry of your brain so that you're not producing crappy chemicals and so that you're increasing your brain's ability to produce good chemicals that will make you feel better, right? You can eat better foods which have chemistry in them, right? It's like I tell the people at the school, everything is a drug to your body, right? Any chemical that you put into your body that is used and decomposed in some manner, shape, or form is considered a drug. So as I've said before on my drug podcast, you know, a drug by any other name is still a drug. So what we're really talking about are good drugs versus bad drugs. And as many of you have heard me say before, the most dangerous drug on the flipping planet, the one that causes more deaths every year, and this is not me pontificating, that you can look this up, right, is sugar. Worst drug on the freaking planet, and it's in almost everything we eat. Second, one of the second most dangerous drugs, hydrogenated fats. They're in almost everything we eat. Go starting tomorrow, go to your grocery store and just turn to the back of the label and start reading labels. I tell every one of my folks to do that. Don't put anything in your mouth unless you know what the heck's in it, right? That not only applies for street drugs, if you're going to be some dummy who's going to use street drugs, right? And, you know, I mean, no disrespect to anybody, but that's just really dumb behavior, using things you don't know what's in there. I mean, that would be like your doctor giving, you know, your physician giving you stuff and go, just take this, it's good for you. What's in it? Well, just take it, it's good for you. I mean, please, you mean to tell me you don't know what you're putting in your body? You don't know what, how many milligrams you're putting in your body? You don't know what the potential side effects are? Give me a break. I mean, I still see people who do that come into my office going, well, I'm on this pink pill. Well, that's real nice. There's 100 pink pills. Which pink pill are you on? And how many milligrams? And, you know, just, oh my flipping Jesus. Anyway, you know, go read the label on some of the food we put in our body, right? Now, I don't put them in my body because I don't eat that crap, but most of you listeners do, and no offense to you because most of you don't know what you're putting in your body. Good. Go read the labels of almost any peanut butter jar, a lot of your salad dressings, a lot of things like your mayonnaises, your dried rice, your instant soup mixes, your popcorn, your potato chips, your, you know, any of those snack foods, the crackers that you eat, pie shells, the prefab pie shells that you buy, a lot of the whipped cream kind of substitute things, a lot of the margarine type substitute things, those Many of those, in fact, I'd say the vast majority of them, are made with hydrogenated fats and oils, which turn into trans fat in your body, which you already know is bad from all the hype the trans fats have gotten. It's unusable fat. Your body cannot use it. You know, your body needs some fat, but not that crap. So if you have a genetic predisposition, or if you have a genetic FUBAR wiring in your brain, which a very small percentage of the folks do, for, let's say, depression or, you know, bipolar disorder or whatever, you have to be very careful about what you eat. The reality is you can't just put bad drugs, bad food drugs, into your body and expect your body to work. You can't bitch smack Mother Nature any more than I can carry 105 or 110-pound Leslie into my car thinking I'm not going to tear, you know, half the muscles in my back and give myself a hernia on top of the one I just had fixed, okay? So, you know, a word to the wise here, right? But you have to be proactive in your mental health. You can't just sit on your laurels and go, well, you know what? Everybody in my family died of a heart attack, so I'm just going to eat what the hell I want because I'm going to die of a heart attack. No, that's not true. You know, you're going to make this prophecy come true by your slack-ass behavior, stuffing a bunch of fatty foods and sugar into your system and sitting up watching bad reruns of TV shows rather than getting out there and doing cardio and getting your blood moving and getting the contaminants out of your system. All right. The other thing I want to talk about a little bit, and all of this, you know, has the underpinning of, if you're saying to yourself, well, gee, this doesn't sound easy. Well, yeah, you're right. It don't come easy. You know, kind of like the song I started this thing out with. Oh, my God, there's the connection, right? You know, say it's not so. But let's face it, living a self-enhanced, self-fulfilled, fullest life you can possibly live, despite whatever you come to the table with out of the chute when you're born through no fault of your own, right? It's hard. It's difficult living a fulfilled life. Existing is easy. Living fully is very, very, very difficult and requires a lot of practice, and you keep doing it, and in some cases, training and education and counseling and whatever, right? So don't be afraid to ask for help if you don't know, because we as a society do a pretty crappy job of teaching people how to get over their stuff and how to be independent and how to rise above their gene pool, right? In fact, we do just the opposite. What we want to tell them is, here, go pop all these pills and you're going to feel better. I mean, when did you ever think you were going to see so many commercials on television for drugs for mental health, many of which we are now finding, oh, gee, you know, you don't want to be on this a long time because they really dysregulate your body and do bad things to your brain. Well, duh. I mean, please, get a clue, okay? Same shit with sugar, same shit with cigarettes. In fact, you know, we have now found out, right, that the tobacco companies have known for years that cigarettes were carcinogenic and just kept it from the public. You know, so don't rely on the government or any institution or the FDA or anybody to protect your patooties, because they're not there to protect you. They're supposed to be, but they're not. I mean, no offense, they're just not doing their job because they're getting paying too many kickbacks to lobbyists who are going there saying, oh, no, that stuff's great. I mean, I don't know if any of you folks remember the tryptophan scare back in the day, but like in the late 80s, there was tryptophan, which, you know, is sort of a thing that slows your brain down, among other things. And it's a quote-unquote natural, you know, chemical. And the health stores were selling it for folks that have sleep issues, right? Particularly that and melatonin and right, this kind of stuff. So what happened is a shipment came over from Asia, I think. And don't quote me on that. I can't remember, but I think it was Asia. And some people died from it or got really sick and were hospitalized. And they said, oh, my God, they had this reaction to this drug, this vitamin, and we need to ban this. So the FDA was just jumping on that bandwagon to ban it. Well, they found out a couple of years later that it had been poisoned, kind of like the Excedrin bottles back, you know, in the 90s when the woman was poisoning her husband and was poisoning Excedrin bottles. I think it was in Washington State. And they found out, well, they put Excedrin back on the shelf within a year, right? It took them like 8 years to get the tryptophan back on the market. 8 years. Why is that? Because if you take vitamins and herbs and healthy stuff, you don't have to go to the physicians as much. And you know what happens if you don't go to physicians as much? You save money. But you know what the bad news is? The medical profession, and no offense to them, because I have buddies who are physicians, and they're great, and I love them, and I love my own physician, right? But as a whole, that group of people loses money. Hospitals lose money. Drug companies, even more importantly, lose money, and they don't like losing money. So they want to keep herbs and vitamins regulated by their government to protect the public. They're not doing a damn thing but protecting their pocketbook. And don't be fooled by that crap, right? But you have to be proactive. You have to find out stuff, right? You have to search and find out and look at reputable sources and find out how you're going to help yourself live a better life, right? Like these, and you know, and kind of tied to this is with the notion of people who have certain disorders. You know, what are we going to do? Are we going to hold certain people responsible for their behaviors if they act in a certain way, if they have certain disorders, right? So recently, I've been made aware, for example, that you have a lot of folks who have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and some of those folks are creating havoc in the community based on certain situations that, you know, sort of trigger some of their stuff. And I don't want anybody with PTSD to mishear what I'm saying, because that's one of my specialty areas. I treat a lot of folks with that. I have a lot of sympathy for those folks. Please don't mishear me, right? And those folks who are doing the work they need to do and working on themselves, I have nothing but respect and admiration for. But there is a group of people in every group, right, whether they're, you know, black, white, green, female, male, you know, heterosexual, bisexual, trisexual, you know, whatever, right? Animal, vegetable, mineral, whatever, right? Who are going to use their mental health status as an excuse for their misbehavior, or an excuse to lay on their butt, or an excuse for you to feel sorry for them, or an excuse for them to feel sorry for themselves, or get money, or whatever, right? And I'm sure all of us know those people. And those people who genuinely have those disorders, who are fighting their hardest to remain as functional and sane and proactive as possible, you folks must really be pissed off at these other people who sit on their butt wanting to get sympathy from folks because they have depression or PTSD or ADHD or whatever. You folks must be ridiculously livid about that. And if you're not, you ought to be. Because those folks who are really trying to get their lives together need awards. They should be commended and given awards, right? But I see these people going, oh, well, I have this and I can't help myself. BS. You can't help yourself by just doing drugs. That's not solving your problem. You know, and no offense, but, you know, if you're doing nothing but drugs for your mental health issues, you need to be bitch smacked, right? Drugs are not solving anything. Medications do not heal anything when you're talking about the mental health field. They rectify brain chemistry, absolutely. And in some cases, they're absolutely needed. And I'm not saying we should just dump all psychotropic medication. Please don't mishear that either, right? There's a time and a place for that stuff. But there are some folks who can certainly do with much less than they're on, and there's certainly folks who can do a lot more with it than they're doing with their lives, than they're doing, whereas they can perhaps in some case taper off the meds they're on, or in some cases get completely off of it. But that requires that nasty four-letter word work. Oh my God, he said it again. Yes, I did. It requires a boatload of work, and it don't come easy, right? Everything in life worth having requires effort, requires work, requires diligence, right? I know, having treated a lot of ADHD people, my father had ADHD, didn't get treated for it because he wanted what a lot of people want. He wanted sympathy and wanted accommodation. And no offense, I'm not picking on ADHD people. There's people with other disorders that want that too, right? He just wanted an excuse for his misbehavior and wanted people to accommodate him, and that was partly because he was a narcissist, and that's what all narcissists want. It really wasn't a function as much of the ADHD. But I have to tell you, most of the ADHD people I've worked with don't really want to change. They want the world to change for them. Well, you know, it'd be great. I'd love for the world to change for me. I'd love for the world to get smarter. I'd love for the world to get better drivers. That's not going to happen anytime soon. You know, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm not God of this world. I wasn't made chief, you know, cook and bottle washer of the planet, you know, and nobody owes me a doggone thing. So I need to adjust my stuff to the general standards of society if I want to interact with people on a regular basis without them, you know, locking me in a rubber room and putting me in an I love myself suit, or putting me in jail to not pass go, to not collect $200. you know, where you really get bad food, okay, and nasty drugs in the food. Nope, you know. So it requires effort, folks. And please don't ever use your psychological problems as sympathy from other people. Don't use your psychological problems as excuse for your misbehavior. And don't use your psychological problems to throw your hands up in the air and go, oh, well, I've got depression. What do you expect me to do? I'm taking my medication, right? Well, I expect you to quit drinking alcohol. Alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. You already have depression. Why are you drinking something that makes your depression worse? And by the way, that's not an atypical situation. Most people with depression, their drug of choice is alcohol. I mean, it makes no sense to me, but it's absolutely true. It's like most ADHD people's drug of choice, right? Drug class of choice are hallucinogens, right? Drug of choice within that group, usually marijuana. People are going, what? Yeah, that's right. Marijuana is a hallucinogen. It is not a relaxant. Right? What is the main? Okay, let's do a chemical review. What is the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana? That's right. Tetra-9-delta-hydrocannabinol, THC, for those non-chemistry nerds out there. And what is THC? That's right. It's a hallucinogen. Oh my gosh. Now, granted, it's a pretty crappy hallucinogen. You're not going to see pink elephants climbing up the Empire State Building unless you really get some good shit, okay? But it is going to space you out. It's going to put you in a state of dissociation, like a trance kind of, oh, wow, dude, right? And that state of dissociation is a form of being out of it, right, which is sort of quote-unquote hallucinatory, right? Now, I'll grant you, it's a crappy hallucinogen, but it's an out-of-spacey drug, which is why most people who have it feel mellow because they're too spaced out to realize how much problems they have and how many things they're not doing and to beat the crap out of themselves and feel like dog do about themselves because they're not doing them. That's why they do it, right? And I've said to people before, and I'm not the first guy to say this, and so I'm not trying to take credit for it, but people use drugs to escape and avoid reality, bottom line. Well, they can say, oh, I do it to have fun. Bullshit. You do it to run away from yourself, who you can't run away from. And if that's the only way you know to have fun, you have a very limited fun vocabulary, because I can do a boatload of stuff to do fun that has nothing to do with ingesting obnoxious chemicals in my body, whether the obnoxious chemicals are nicotine or sugar or cocaine or alcohol. Doesn't matter. They're all bad, okay? So if you have one of these issues, I'm not slamming you. I'm just saying get help. Don't play the sympathy card. Don't try to throw your hands up and accept the fact, oh, yes, I inherited a bad brain from my parents. I have depression. We've seen that, you know, my depression circuits don't work. I need to be doing something for my depression. I guess I'll just have to be on antidepressant meds the rest of my life. Well, maybe not. Maybe if you change the way you eat, if you eat foods that have more energy in them, if you have foods that cause your brain to differentiate better, like omega-3s or omega-9s or omega-6s, right? Maybe if you increase your protein intake, bioavailable protein, by the way, right? Things like legumes, you know, beans, lentils, you know, it takes the body, or soy, unless you're allergic to that, right? Takes your body 4 days to process red meat, with the protein in red meat. It takes none of that for your body to process the soy protein in a protein shake, or in tofu, or in beans, or anything else. Now, again, you know, if you're allergic to wheat and gluten, obviously you can't be doing that. But honestly, that's a very, very small, very, very, very small segment of the population. So don't let this gluten scare, gluten-free, well, that's great. But you know what? Gluten's a good thing if you're not allergic to it. Milk is, you know, cheese is a good thing. Yogurt has a ton of protein in it. Especially low-fat and no-fat yogurt has all yogurt has protein in it, but low-fat yogurt also minimizes the fat content, right? Well, if you're lactose intolerant, you know, you can't do cow's milk, you sure as heck aren't doing ice cream, you sure as heck aren't doing yogurt. Is yogurt a bad drug? No. It's a great drug, unless you're allergic to it. Penicillin's a great drug, unless you're allergic to it. So don't let this gluten scare thing freak you out, okay? It's way, way overhyped. Way overhyped, in my personal opinion. Okay? But whatever it is, do things that are healthy for your body. Change your eating habits. Don't sit on your butt as much. Do cardiovascular. One of the things I tell every anxiety and depressive person to do is to do cardiovascular. And I'm not talking about training for the Boston Marathon, although that would be a good thing. You don't have to be that crazy. You don't have to be that dedicated, that zealous. All you got to do is do cardiovascular 3 to 5 times a week. And if you have an inherited, you know, serotonin deficient brain because of biochemical wiring, no fault of your own, do cardio 7 days a week. You know, how hard is it to get out and walk around a track? Or how hard is it to get on a stationary bicycle and ride for 20, 30 minutes? I mean, this is not rocket science. This is not lifting 100-pound Leslie's out of your car, okay, and being a dumbass like me, right? This is taking care of your body and making your body breathe better. You're going to clear out the contaminants. You're going to make your brain do better. You're going to get more oxygen to your brain. Do things that are good for you. Watch funny movies. Hang out with friends who are supportive and fun. Don't hang out with a bunch of losers, no offense to anybody, who are always crying poor mouth or who are always depressed or who are always pissed off. Right. If you hang around that stuff, it has a tendency to impact you. And if you're a person who is particularly susceptible to environmental influences, you don't want to hang around negative people. You want to hang around positive people. You want to hang around people who are proactive, who are taking charge of their lives. Right. Who have good sense of self, who have a lot of self-efficacy. They believe that they are able to manage life's challenge, that they are efficacious, that they have efficiency in their lives. That's what the term self-efficacy means. People who have high self-efficacy usually have high self-esteem, right? Think about what that word means. I have value in myself. I have high self-worth. I have high self-esteem. If you base your esteem and your self-worth on what other people say about you or how many cars you have in your driveway or how many Leslies you have in your studio, that's not self-esteem. I call that other esteem, because you're basing yourself on what other people or other things that you possess or live in or drive or have sex with or whatever your yardstick is. You're valuing yourself by external measurements. That's not a good thing to do. Now, you know, if you want to say, well, you know, I'm 30 years old and I'm only in the 12th grade, okay, maybe you should be looking at, you know, what your peer group's doing. But in terms of your self-worth and self-efficacy, you have to develop that on your own. And you do that by working hard to overcome the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, as Shakespeare might say. It's not about giving up. It's not about getting drunk and escaping. It's not about shooting up heroin and escaping. It's not about eating a ton of sugar, which is the most addictive drug on the planet and does more damage than heroin. Okay? We're talking serious stuff here. Go read your labels. Eat energy foods. Eat foods that have a lot of chlorophyll in them. Right? Chlorophyll goes to the mitochondria in your cells, right? Which are the little tiny organelles inside your cells that are like energy transformers, right? And so they energize your body, and they like chlorophyll, green stuff, right? Especially things like Japanese seaweed, kale, collards, spinach, broccoli, right? Those things will help your body produce energy. Adenosine triphosphate, you know, ATP, those of you who work out, you should know that immediately, right? You athletes out there, you should know that. Why do you think all these performance athletes eat so much spinach? Hello, McFly. Come on, people, right? Increase your bioavailable protein. Increase your chlorophyll, right? Reduce your fats. Eat enough fats for your body to work on, because lipids or fats are your body's prima facie energy motivators, but eat them wisely and don't eat bad fats your body can't process. Don't eat trans fat. Don't eat hydrogenated fats, right? Eat real fats that your body can use. Don't, you know, eat, you know, as Geddy Lee describes some pop music, foods with empty calories. I love that. You know, you just don't want to eat. You want to put crap in your mouth. You know, garbage in, garbage out. Right? Think of the old computer adage, right? You put garbage data in a computer, you get garbage solutions out. Well, you know what? That's even more important for your body. Right? You put bad food in your body, you're going to make yourself depressed. You're going to make yourself pissed off. You're going to make yourself tired. you know, you're going to make yourself stressed out if you eat a lot of amphetamine-like foods. You know, you drink tons of coffee, you consume tons of those energy drinks that have a shit ton, excuse my French, of amphetamine-like substances and sugar. Oh, my flipping Jesus. Yeah, and sugar's not an amphetamine, it's a simple carbohydrate, right? So for those of you who don't know, well, whoa, why does sugar give me a rush? Because sugar is like sticking your finger in an electric socket. Eating sugar shocks the crap out of your body. Refined sugar, right? Which is why you also don't want to eat white bread and white rice and white pastas, right? Because what does that stuff turn into the body if it's not used? That's right, sugar. This is why, you know, guys have big stomachs. If, you know, if they eat a ton of sugar, they tend to get big stomachs as they get older, and chicks get bigger hips and bigger tushes, right? And unless you really want to go, you know, to an old school disco and do some serious bumping with a big tush, you probably want to stay away from the white bread and the white rice and the white pasta and the white sugar, particularly if you're not going to run the Boston Marathon. Right now, if you're going to go do, you know, a triathletic event and you want to do some sugar, body's going to burn it off. That's fine. But most of us aren't doing that. Right? We're not. We're not jacking it. We're not, you know, destabilizing our hyperglycemic levels of our body and putting our body into shock, which is essentially what sugar's doing. It's stimulating you because your body's going, what the hell is this crap? Right? It's not because, oh yeah, I'm stimulating the dopamine receptors by putting more amphetamines in my system like nicotine or caffeine or theophylline or cocaine. You know, I'm shocking the crap out of my body. I'm destabilizing the hyperglycemic level of my body. You know, and you have any kind of heart problems in your family, obesity, hypoglycemia, high blood pressure, diabetes, you need to cut that stuff out. Right? You want to get sweet? You know, use agave nectar, use stevia or stevia, however you want to pronounce it, or honey, right? Use anything except processed white sugar. Use brown sugar more. But, you know, everything in moderation, right? Remember, everything in moderation, even good foods are too much, right? It's like I tell the kids at the school, right? Water's a great drug for your body. It's one of the best things you can do for yourself, right? But you can get too much water. It's called drowning. I mean, seriously, but you don't get enough water, it's called dehydration, and you die. Air is the same way. Anything in the body works according to a balance. Balancing your protein with your fats, with your carbohydrates. Everything in body is in balance. You know, if you don't know this stuff, read up on it. Consult a dietary person. Consult a nutritionist. Consult your physician if he or she is knowledgeable about it. Or any health practitioner, holistic health practitioner who's knowledgeable about it. Right? A lot of chiropractors are real knowledgeable about this stuff. Right? Don't sit on your butt. Google the internet. Talk to people about it. Ask friends who are, you know, who are knowledgeable about this stuff. Don't believe the crap you see on TV. They're not out to help you, they're out to sell stuff. I mean, come on. America is a capitalistic society. It's based on money movement. And I love it. I'm not knocking it, but you don't want to get people money circulating at the cost of their health. That's just not a smart thing to do, except we do it a lot in this country, right? How many times have you seen an advertisement for really good, healthy foods versus things like Pop-Tarts or toaster strudel, right? And I'm not slamming those things, right? Anything with gobs of sugar on it. Cheetos, Doritos, right? And I'm not slamming any of those people. I'm really, really not. But if you want to live a long life, you don't want to be eating a lot of that crap. And you sure as hell don't want to be eating it if you're sitting on your butt and not exercising and burning it off. And if you have certain medical conditions, you want to avoid that stuff, just like you want to avoid a boatload of salt if you have high blood pressure. It's not real good for you. And if you're going to use salt, better to use the sea salt. It has less added chemicals in it. And if you taste the sea salt, right, or the kosher salt, and you taste the stuff that's refined, that has all the metallic stuff in it, it tastes completely different. I mean, it's a completely different animal. You will shock yourself. Completely different animal. I stopped using what I call manufactured salt, oh my God, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. I haven't used regular salt in I don't know how long. I started grinding my own salt at the table long before it was fashionable. I just like the taste of it. It tastes better. You know, and it's a lot less of a shock to your system, and you use less of it. I do the same thing with pepper. I crack my own pepper, grind my own pepper. It's fresher. It smells better. You use less of it. Everything in moderation. It's like I tell people, when you're going to go eat, right? You don't go shopping at the grocery store when you're starving. You're going to buy everything on the table. That's what most of these fast food places are counting on. You're in a hurry. You waited too long to eat. Your system is going, feed me now, or we're going to kick you in the butt. And you go by one of these places, and you go, holy shoes, I'm going to go in there and buy every burger or fish sandwich, or, well, fish sandwich would be better for you, but I'm going to buy everything this person has for sale on the counter, and then some. Right? You start reading labels. Put good food in your system. Don't just think you're doomed because you have PTSD or depression or anxiety. And don't say, oh, gee, I'm just having one of my, you know, bipolar moments, or I'm having one of my borderline moments, or I'm having one of my anxiety moments. You know, people aren't required to put up with your crap any more than they're required to put up with my crap, right? So when I'm feeling real pissy or in a bad mood or agitated or angry or just grumpy or whatever because I haven't had enough sleep or whatever my issue is, right, I usually isolate myself from people, or I usually warn folks that are going to interact with me, hey, I'm a little grumpy today, excuse me if I don't say this right. You know, I take responsibility for it because it is my responsibility. It doesn't matter that I have a sleep disorder. That's not other people's problem. It's my problem. And because I have the problem, it's my problem to try to either fix it or accommodate myself into society as much as I possibly can. And that's all any of us can do. But I don't just go, well, you just have to put up with me. I'm grouchy because I didn't get sleep, so screw you. No, I'm sorry, that doesn't work. You have to take responsibility for your stuff. Even if it's not your, you know, it's not my fault I have the sleep disorder, okay? I inherited it from my mom's side of the family. It may not be your fault, quote unquote, that you have bipolar disorder or that you have clinical depression or that you have whatever. But you know what? It's your responsibility to manage it. And it's your responsibility not to use an excuse for your misbehavior, right? I did an interview many years ago when the Menendez case came up. And, you know, the interviewer said, well, you know, these guys were abused. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but abuse is not an excuse. If that were an excuse, half of us in this country would be, you know, raving lunatics and killing people and crashing people into cars. I mean, I don't say that to be funny or joking, but, I mean, a lot of us have experienced abuse that's not quite as profoundly aware in the public's awareness as people who've been physically or sexually abused or kidnapped, you know, or abducted by aliens or whatever, right? But you know what? Emotional abuse hurts just as badly. And if you have parents who are emotionally abusive to you on a continuous basis, right, that hurts. It leaves lasting impressions on you. But it's your job to try to manage it as best you can, or try to figure out how you're going to cover it up or how you're going to accommodate it so that you're not abusing somebody else. Right, and I'm not talking out of my butt because I'm one of those people. Right, my father was hugely abusive up to the day he died because he was a narcissist. Now, he was a narcissist because he developed as a defense against his own abuse. Well, you know what? I'm sorry. That's not my problem. He should have fixed that shit before he thought about getting married and before he thought about having kids and passed the buck to other people. But he didn't. And shame on him for not doing it. And I made a decision a long time ago. I wasn't going to use that as my excuse because I know how it feels, and I know what it does to people because I see him do it to everybody when he was still alive. And I'm not doing that to people. You have a responsibility that no matter what you get, it's your responsibility to either fix it as best you can, or if you can't fix it, accommodate it to the best of your ability and try to make the best of what you got. It's not easy, and I'm the first to tell you it's not easy. But you can't just go along and do the same shit other people seem to be able to do that don't have these issues. You just can't. That's reality, right? You don't like reality, complain to God. But the reality is reality. I tell everybody that. It's not good, bad, right, wrong, sucks, unfair, fair. Those are all social euphemisms, right? I tell everybody there is no such thing as unfairness. How do I know that? Because if life were fair, quote unquote, people wouldn't need to see me to fix their problems. People wouldn't get abducted. People wouldn't get beaten up. People wouldn't get tortured. People wouldn't die from starvation or AIDS or cancer or leukemia. But they do. So we already know out the box there is no such concept as fairness. It doesn't exist. Society has somehow manifested it, probably from religion. And I'm not slamming religion. I'm just telling you the reality. To think somehow that, you know, good people always triumph and bad people always suffer. And that's not true, people. Sorry, it's not true. A lot of good people suffer who don't need to suffer. And a lot of bad people get away with it for a long period of time, and some of them get away with it till they drop dead. And I don't know what's on the other side, so I can't speak for that. I don't know what kind of justice they get. That's not my purview. Right, but I can tell you there's a lot of bad people in this world, and I'm sure most of you folks have seen one or two in your time. And they just seem to get away with stuff and get away with stuff and get away with stuff. And therefore, you know there is no such thing as fairness. So get that out of your vocabulary. It doesn't exist. You'll only make yourself more angry or disgruntled or depressed or upset. Get it out of your system. Why does it happen? Because it happens. Do you like it? No, and you don't have to like it, and you don't have to accept it, but you do have to live with it, right? And the alternative is not very helpful. So make the best with what you have. Never give up. Always strive to be the best you can be. In that way, you are, again, and you heard me say this before, you are taking the power that lies within each one of you. Each one of you has a powerhouse of chemicals in your brain. Each one of you has a powerhouse of inner reserve if you will only believe in it and tap in it. I really mean that. I'm not being funny. Every one of you has amazing recuperative skills that you have no idea that you have. But you've got to start little and grow and build. Do not throw your hands up and despair, and do not blame society or your parents or anybody else for your stuff. Take responsibility for your stuff, not necessarily blame, but take responsibility. Take ownership of it to do something about it, even if you didn't create it. And I know it's hard, and I know it's inconvenient, but you know what? So is living fully. So is living a good life. For most of us, it's a struggle. In my personal opinion, it's worth the effort. I can't make that decision for everybody. Each one of you has to make that decision on his or her own. But I really advise you to please make the effort and believe in yourself that you can do it, because it's not a specifically special, oh my God, only people with 140 or higher IQs can do, or only people who are born into, you know, silver spoon families. Anybody can do it. And I've seen some pretty amazing stuff from people that you would least expect to do it, under the normal quote-unquote stereotype. So that's my spiel for today. Don't use your stuff as an excuse. It can be an explanation for your behavior, but explanations are not excuses for misbehavior. They are descriptions of the challenges that befall each and every one of us, whether it's ADHD, sleep disorder, PTSD, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, doesn't matter. They are descriptions of our challenges in life that we have to master, or they will master us. And I don't like that idea very much. And I hope those listeners who are hearing this don't like it either. Always live as best as you can. Always strive for the gusto. Thanks for listening. I'll be back.